Okay, let me just count you 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 15. And I know the Phil Litz can't make it in a... Okay. So just some pragmatic questions to start with. First, I've had responses from most of you to my emails. Are you all getting my emails? Yes? Has everybody received and you've all got copies of the syllabus? Yes, okay. Just out of interest, who was able to download and read over the summer from that website, the introductory lectures, 5 introductory lectures? Yeah, most of you have had a look at those. Good, excellent, because they're very good introductions to the course in general and to this week and next week in particular. That first lecture on trauma by Freud is very useful, okay, and very clear. Have you all been able to access the scanned texts and download? Yes? No one's had insuperable difficulties, right? Okay, fine. as you're aware, buying text for a course like this is tricky because one's pulling essays and chapters from all over the place. It's not easy. It's not like a novel a week or something like that where there's a single book and it's really obvious. I listed in the course description that I sent out to you 3 months ago some books that it's worth buying because they've got a lot of these. They've got a number of texts we'll be looking at in them, okay. And you then have a book at the end of it, not just some photocopies. But I'm pulling essays and stuff out from a range of different sources. So rather than simply, you know, it's impossible to buy all the books they come from unless you're very wealthy. Downloading is the thing to do so that you bring your text with you to the seminars and the lectures, because I will be talking about key passages in the text and you do need to have them in front of you, okay? And I think, as I said to you on the emails I sent out, it's much cheaper to download at home, okay? Because the library, well, last year it cost 6p a shot. Of course, it only recently hit me. The way they've scanned the texts, they don't, like you photocopy a book, you get 2 pages for one shot. They scan each one separately, so that makes it more expensive if you're paying 6p a shot. So for the ones you have to scan, it's much better to print them off on your own printer rather than on the university ones, because otherwise it mounts up, as you'll discover. So that's just... practical questions. Any problems or questions about the practical side of the course, the organisation of seminars, lectures, etc.?
I couldn't get the letter. And you sent me an email with a letter to Lisa.
That hadn't been photocopied, and a number of the letters to Lisa are in the handout I've just given you. Okay. Any questions before I start talking about Freud and trauma? Okay, right. Okay, so I've given you a selection of materials on trauma and Freud's changing thoughts and positions about trauma as he struggles with the experience of trauma. And this is where psychoanalysis begins. It begins with Freud's encounter with patients suffering with what today would be called post-traumatic stress disorder. How to conceptualize trauma, how does it operate, and how do you deal with the suffering of people who are in the grip of trauma, traumas that can last for years and even decades afterwards, okay? Now, as I said in my email out to you for this week, Freud begins life as a really hardline materialist or a hardline physicalist. He's training in Vienna, okay? And he saw his future at the beginning as a research scientist working in a laboratory who was going to be cutting up bodies, animals, and very small, strange little creatures whose structure of whose cerebral cortex and spinal cord was simpler and more easy to map. This is taking place at a point in the 1850s and 60s where... medical science is making enormous breakthroughs around mapping the human nervous system. And mapping the spinal column and the cerebral cortex and the ways in which various forms of physical damage to parts of the spine have slightly surprising effects. You know, they produce paralyses in odd parts of the body that people didn't know were connected up, etc. And a kind of mapping process is taking a place, and a whole series of discoveries and breakthroughs are being made in the understanding of the way the spinal cord, the brain, relates to the rest of the body. And that's very much where Freud was. That's where he was at, and that's what he did. Right, and so a hard-line physicalist for any of these kinds of damage and symptoms that you can see, there's a physical cause in the body, what was technically called a lesion. Okay. However, Freud gets a grant to go to Paris for 6 or 8 months to study with the great Charcot, Jean-Martin Charcot, the founder of neurology as a discipline, okay? Somebody who's key to mapping the brain, spinal cord, nervous system functions and malfunctions. And Charcot was in charge of a great hospital in Paris, La Salpêtrière, which had a long stay population of some 3,000 women. Who were in various ways disabled and who spent decades of their lives there and died there. The records of the hospital, as he organized by Charcot, reorganized by Charcot, it maps the progression of a whole range of diseases that people didn't understand. And he meticulously maps the development of symptoms. And because he's got this long-stay population, he can trace them to the point where they actually die, and then he cuts them up. And he establishes correlations between sets of syndromes and the structure of the brain, the structure of the spinal cord. You know, a correlation is set up between what can be seen in the consulting room and what can be uncovered on the dissecting table. Okay, so there's and he maps this in and conceptualizes whole syndromes. And categories of diseases. Freud, in his obituary for Charcot, compared him to, on the one hand, the great Cuvier, who in the 19th century mapped animal species and genera and subspecies, etc., and also to the figure of Adam in the book of Genesis, who named all the animals that God brought before him. So Charcot was the great namer and categorizer of fields of disease, of nosology, what's called nosology, of a kind of conceptual mapping of the body and its interrelated diseases, establishing correlations between visible clusters of symptoms that occur regularly and predictably, and underlying lesions to key parts of the body, and to the brain, cerebral cortex, spinal column, etc., etc. Freud found that when he arrived in Paris, there was no room for him in the laboratories. It was overcrowded with visitors, and so he couldn't participate in that side of Charcot's work. One gets the sense from the letters that he's not too disappointed, because the other side of Charcot was Charcot, the great performer. Charcot gave these astonishing lectures to which Le Tout Paris would turn up. The writers, the intellectuals, would turn up to see Charcot lecturing on hysteria. He would bring on his hysterical patients. He would hypnotize them, and he would do the most extraordinary things with them. And Freud was profoundly shocked and shaken by what he saw, because Charcot would bring on people who, might be paralyzed down one half of their body. They'd come in dragging their paralyzed limbs, maybe even an eye on that side, etc. He would hypnotize them, and he would switch the paralysis to the other side of their body and wake them up, and they'd wake up and they'd be doing it on the other side. And this is profoundly shocking for somebody working within that emergent, hardline, physicalist scientific paradigm, this apparent disconnection between bodily symptoms and physical causes. Okay, how could this be? How could you just switch symptoms in that kind of way? And it was a great theatrical, you know, the theatre of hysteria, and there are famous paintings of Charcot as he puts his hysterics through their paces in front of this audience of writers and intellectuals as well as clinicians. You know, the La Grande Hysterie, he mapped the hysterical attack in particular and schematized it into four stages. So he's a mapper of symptom clusters, and he's looking for underlying physical causes, because that's how he worked when he had mapped so much of the field of neurology and brain damage and brain disorder and established his position. And he addresses himself at the point where Freud comes to Paris to hysteria. Now, hysteria had been a very unstable category. Going back to the Greeks, the word comes from the Greek word hysteron, meaning womb. It was felt to be, by the Greeks and by a lot of traditional classical medicine, a disease of women, and a disease, a gynecological disease. And so you get Galen and others giving descriptions of the womb wandering around the body. And often it was seen to be the expression of a kind of desire or of a hunger, unsatisfied hunger. So it was a kind of mental, physical set of effects produced by the unsatisfied female womb. And you get this in King Lear. When Lear's going mad, he says, on the heath, hysterica passio, the climbing mother, meaning the womb, that is climbing up. And one of the ways in which the hysterical attack was described was in terms of feeling these constrictions and compressions in the chest and in breathing. And a sense of suffocation, something, a ball, a hysterical ball, was rising up into the throat, and it precipitated the classic hysterical attack. And in the Greeks, and actually in gynecology right up into the 20th century, it was seen to be the womb. Now, the fact that King Lear metaphorically sees himself in those terms, and the fact indicates that, you know, its assignment to women or to the female sex, though it's built into the name, wasn't something that medical opinion universally held to. And indeed, in the 19th century, you get a great split between the different branches of medicine. Gynecology went on, in Britain in particular, which was particularly conservative in these areas, talking about this sort of thing right into the 20th century. However, by the mid-century in France, a number of authorities had disconnected hysteria from, and the classic hysterical attack, from, as it were, female physiology, and did not see it as a gynecological question. And Binet, B-I-N-E-T, Charcot's predecessor, had written a great text on hysteria. He talks about hysteria in men and in women. And it is true as well that certain leading British medical theorists in the 19th century talked about a non-gendered hysteria as non-gendered, as it were. One of the things hysteria did, puzzlingly, was that it imitated other diseases. And this was very puzzling, so that people would come on with the apparent symptoms of a given well-known identifiable disease, and yet nobody could find the physical causes that should produce the symptoms. Okay, and this was a puzzle. One British medical theorist, his name Benjamin Brodie, I think, Sir Benjamin Brodie, talks about neuromimesis, that somehow or other parts of the neurological system imitate physically caused diseases. And it was a puzzle as to why this should be, and it meant you often see Freud, the early Freud, in his texts worrying about, you know, am I treating something that's physically caused as hysteria? Or, you know, have I got it right? And it's a kind of, you know, this looks very much like a particular disease pattern, but it could be hysteria, or the other way around. I'm thinking it's hysteria. Have I missed the physical cause? Okay, so there was this profound ambiguity about this strange capacity of hysteria to mimic existing disease syndromes without having the physical causes. So there's a disconnect there that was puzzling. And, of course, that's, in a way, what Charcot is dramatizing and being increasingly puzzled by when he switches the symptoms from the left to the right side, etc. Okay, and he's in hysterics, in his public theater of hysteria. That there are certain mental conditions that are played out on the body and through the body, but are not determined by the body. They are, in fact, determined by ideas, with the argument. So we get this thesis of the ideogenesis of hysteria, that hysteria is caused by certain ideas that have gained a kind of power over the body and its functions, ideas of which the hysterical subject is not aware consciously. Okay. And Charcot works his way round to this in his late work, and he tries to correlate it with even in one of the anomalies he had, that even in physical accidents, classically trained train crashes and workplace accidents, where the subjects were very often male, what you get is somebody coming under a huge physical impact of some kind, getting a minor bruise or some minor damaging, and then a month later, 2 months later, 3 months later, developing a paralysis. So there's this strange incubation period. How can this be? He walked away from the accident, and now his legs are paralyzed. What? And of course, this became a legal and financial question very quickly, because people would then make claims and insurance claims against the railway company. And the railway lawyers would say, yeah, but he walked away. What do you mean? He may be paralyzed now, but couldn't have been caused by the accident. So it became an urgent issue and a real anomaly, and people argued over it ferociously. There was a German school that claimed you just couldn't find the micro-level lesions and fractures that were causing it. Charcot shocked a lot of them by saying, you know, what we're dealing with as these trauma victims is hysteria. so he was, as it were, assimilating the category of trauma and its effects to the pre-existing category of hysteria. Okay, something caused by not the physical impact, but the mental impact, the state of shock and fright as somebody is taken by surprise by a physical impact, and that state of shock or fright splits consciousness and creates a set of memory stroke ideas associated with different parts of the body that have been impacted. Okay, and it's not the physical damage, but the working through of these mental split off, disconnected mental associations that are at the root of this strange incubation at a later point of hysterical symptoms. Okay, he schematizes in particular the hysterical attack, Le Grand Hysterie, and the handout I've given you will show you. I've given you extracts from a book on Charcot, a series of photographs taken in La Salpêtrière, because everything was photographed. And measured their sweat, because the hysterics did the most extraordinary things. You know, they would develop in their bodies an inability, for instance, to urinate. And what would happen, the urine would come out through their tear ducts or through their sweat glands. And Charcot and his doctors would kind of measure them, you know, the quantity of urine secreted through other parts of the body, etc. So you get this derangement of the body, which is physically measured and tracked down in all kinds of ways and photographed. So if you look at the handouts, you'll get the four stages of the hysterical attack as nominated by Charcot. And in particular, I think it's phase three, which he calls the attitude passionnelle, is a moment in which after the initial seizures and clonic spasms of the body, which are quite extraordinary. If you turn the page over and look at some of I think the one of the man at the back is the most extraordinary one, but some of the others are pretty weird. The arc en cercle of the body going into the spine spasming backwards, as it were. And there's this guy standing on all fours backwards on his head in phase two of the Grand Hysterie. If you, where is it? Has it not come out? This is my favourite photograph from La Sop. There it is. There he is. There, doing this extraordinary backward somersault. But he's holding that posture in a state of kind of spasm. Extraordinary thing. But the next phase is where they start talking. To that point, cries or groans, at a certain point, a kind of stream of words, almost like a late Beckett play, you know, not I or something, you know, this kind of verbal diarrhea, which were then meticulously taken down and transcribed, pages and pages and pages and pages of these deliria, as it were, which were treated almost as in the same way as the measuring of the kind of body temperature or the excretion of urine or whatever it might be was measured. But extraordinarily, they weren't listened to. It's almost as if the words were treated like physical products of the body. Their bavardage, Charcot called it, you know, their chatter. Or they would say of, you know, one of the hysterics, oh, she's talking to her invisibles. Okay, so they weren't interpreted, they weren't listened to in the sense of taken seriously. And what Freud notes is that actually what are being replayed in these attitude passionnelle are scenes, dramatic moments, as it were. And it's that stage three that Freud, as it were, takes both the growing point of his own thought and eventually the exit from the Charcotian paradigm. He goes back to Vienna, completely bowled over by Charcot. Until the end of his days, he kept a photograph of Charcot by his chair in his consulting room in Vienna as the great master. But he actually came to disagree with Charcot quite strongly, particularly around the question of heredity. For Charcot, hysteria is finally, he couldn't find the physical lesions. Okay. However many dead hysterics he cut up, he couldn't find the cause of in terms of a lesion of the physical nervous system. And in his last work, which was a long dictionary entry in English on hysteria in a British medical encyclopedia, he says, you know, it is without lesion. Is it a disease? Is it maybe it's just a strange mode of sensibility? But he tends to see it as being transmitted as a hysterical constitution, something that's inherited, okay, and that is activated by a whole series of pressures. It might be an accident, a physical accident. It might be a series of emotional distresses that activate this pre-given thing. Okay, and there's a tendency in Charcot's thought to go into two different directions. One, to try and hold on to the notion of physical causation by saying it's an inherited disposition that comes down the family line in the family tree. Hence, there would be a lot of interrogation of, you know, illnesses in your previous generation, as it were. And they would map all the diseases of the hysteric going back two or three generations, trying to trace a kind of transmission belt down the generations, as it were, in an attempt to sort of hold on to some notion of physical causation. At the same time, he develops this notion of ideas that have been split off by in states of shock or fright, which then have this causal power over the body. And that's very much an idea that Breuer, Freud's co-author in the studies on hysteria, sticks with. Freud abandons that idea or sees the hypnoid state, as being itself a symptom of another cause and not the main cause itself. So he takes a different path. But Freud, in particular, breaks with Charcot. He translated Charcot from French into German and wrote his own disagreement with Charcot into the footnotes, which Charcot was very pissed off by, over the question of heredity. Okay. Freud felt that it could not be established, and that you claim that the aunt or the mother or the father was a hysteric or had syphilis, which was supposed to be closely related to or to have produced hysterical effects. But how do you know their hysteria wasn't an acquired hysteria? How do you know it was inherited? It's a kind of, you know, a chicken and egg thing. You just go back further and further and further, hypothesizing that it must have come from someone else, somewhere else, as it were. So Freud breaks with that and promotes to the place of chief cause the idea of the shock of trauma. Okay, that isn't for Charcot. That's just an agent provocateur. It what precipitates out the pre-existing inherited historical constitution, as it were. And there are other causes that might do that. But, you know, the traumatic event is merely a precipitating agent. Or he uses this metaphor of the agent provocateur, the figure in his little metaphor who sort of plants something and then disappears, and then a month later the bomb explodes. This sort of thing was happening all over Europe at the time. And in the essay I asked you to read by Breuer and Freud, the 1893 essay on the psychical mechanism of historical phenomena, he argues that the kind of causation that we're getting in trauma is not that of an agent provocateur, of something that's being planted and then at a later point it's just kind of reactivated by something that comes along and precipitates it into action, as it were. But rather, it's a persisting cause. Okay, the cause doesn't vanish away like an agent provocateur. It remains like a foreign body. So against the metaphor of the agent provocateur, Freud has this metaphor of the traumatic causal element for hysteria is a persisting foreign element, foreign body, is the metaphor he uses. Something that is unavailable to the consciousness of the historical subject, but which acts on them unwittingly or unbeknownst to them, as it were. Are there any questions people want to ask about what I said so far? Puzzles, confusions?
In terms of action, because we're studying Freud, is he, I guess, correct in his analysis? Like, should we accept this as sort of a fact and how the mind works, or is it sort of his idea?
Well, I'm approaching Freud partly by watching how his ideas develop, right, and how the process of concept formation and theory formation, which comes out of a clinical experience of a particular kind of problem. How do I deal with people who are suffering in this kind of way? Okay, so that's the first point to make. The second point to make is that, for instance, and this is a little anecdote in the history of medicine, Charcot was extraordinarily influential. People came from all over North America and Europe to study with Charcot. Within a couple of years of his death, because he hadn't found the physical lesion, a physical lesion that could be the specifiable physical cause for this extraordinarily florid Baroque symptomologies that he's describing acted out by hysterics, the whole thing begins to collapse. You know, some of his most loyal students change their mind, and accusations are made that have partial truth to them, that the great theatre of hysteria was some, you know, the hysterics knew their script. You know, they knew what to do when they came on stage, as it were. Okay, so there was an enormous anti-Charcotian turn, at least on the area of hysteria. I think his successors as a neurologist were absolutely unshakable. Okay, but around the question of hysteria and the schematization of the Grand Attack, etc., there was a huge turning against it. And then the First World War came. And then suddenly people started getting soldiers coming back from the trenches, behaving like some of the women in La Salpêtrière. And so in a way, what had been pushed to one side in the whole sort of negative or skeptical reaction against Charcot and his the incompleteness of his attempt to sustain a physical causal paradigm is put on the agenda again. Suddenly you get, you know, that kind of frozen, fixated, repetitive, traumatized behavior from the soldiers coming from the trenches, as it were. So it puts that, if you like, that traumatic symptomology back on the agenda again. I've actually came across a fascinating article in the British Medical Journal. Now, when was that? Was it in the 60s, I think, or maybe a bit later even? Two British doctors working in the Appalachian Mountains in the States, in the South. Right? And if you know about the culture of the Appalachian Mountains, it's extraordinary sort of mountain culture of people who are in all sorts of ways culturally disconnected from the rest of America. And they live in a kind of partly in a time warp of their own. And they say when you are getting classic cases of the kind Shako described coming into the hospitals, and there they have photographs of patients doing these things that you see here from the 1870s and 80s and 90s, as it were. And you can't make the argument about them. It's all been scripted by Shako, or it's been scripted by their doctors or whatever, because the doctors didn't believe in it. Okay, and so they're astonished to find people going through their paces, as it were. Another rather interesting piece I read by Mark McCarley, one of the historians of hysteria, where doctors in the Vienna General Hospital in the 1960s are saying, well, initially the line was, it's funny how we don't come across hysterics anymore. You know, they were an artifact produced by turn-of-the-century fantasy-ec medicine, right? And then they started saying, but actually, we do come across these things. We come across these things in the Gastarbeiter, okay? The people from peasant cultures, from the Sicilian workers, the Turkish workers, who, when they have certain kinds of breakdowns, God help us, there they are. They're doing the Shako's hysterical attack. Again, you can't say about these people from other cultures or even from barely literate peasant rural cultures that they've been scripted by some medical eminence, as it were. So in a sense, the whole question of hysteria and the symptomology of hysteria was being put back on the agenda again in all kinds of ways, as it were. Okay. What I'm trying to trace is Freud's encounter with that and the way it challenges his physicalist paradigm. And in a sense pushes him into psychology almost against his will, and not into general psychology but into a particular form of psychology. Okay. Now, what I'm hoping we might do is in the seminars look at the case studies I've asked you to read, okay, and track Freud's shifts from the earliest, most simple model to later, more complex models, okay? Particularly around this question of the disconnect between cause and symptom, okay? He begins in the 1893 paper with Breuer with a kind of, even there, the simple model is being challenged, but at least it's articulated there, that, there's a cause, it impacts, and there's a specifiable effect. And there may be a time gap between them, but, you can set up a cause-effect connection pretty clearly, okay? But what's puzzling is where, in tracing back the symptom, using this technique that his mentor Breuer had kind of almost stumbled upon, of putting the patient into hypnosis, as it were, and trying to access... the famous case is the case of Anna O, where she goes into kind of her absences, where she just withdraws from the world, and she seems in some private world of her own, a private delirium. And he captures certain words, certain phrases from her deliria, and then he hypnotizes her and puts them back to her and gets her to talk in hypnosis around the phrases that he's overheard from her deliria when she's... when she's kind of conscious, but not absent at the same time, and she then starts rehearsing scenes, okay, rehearsing memories, and he maps them in this kind of meticulous way under about headings. Some headings like loss of hearing or something like that. You can have anything, 100 different memory sequences, right? Sequences build up. There's this extraordinary, memorial system that is below the level of consciousness, but which seems to sort of kick in some way behind her deliria, and which initially Breuer and later Freud, trying to put Breuer's technique into action, tries to access through hysteria, as it were. And the technique at that point is very much that of the god doctor asking questions. When did you first feel this? Remember, try to work back, when did you first have this symptom? And the doctor has all these questions he wants to put to the patient and insists that, okay, we're treating this symptom today and I want you to answer me as truthfully as possible, or I want you to tell me about this. Now, what Freud's hysterical patients teach him and force him to learn is basically to shut up. Stop asking me questions. Listen to what I'm saying. in a way, say, Charcot, who had stared at these people, he was a great visuel, and photographed them, okay, but he hadn't listened to what they were saying, right? He'd written it down, and it's all there in the records of La Salpêtrière, these terrible stories that some of the women tell of rape, sexual abuses, children, whatever, you know, which are just treated as, she's talking to her invisibles. They're not carrying meaning, as it were. So Freud's, initially, Anna O, of course, was Breuer's patient, not Freud's. Anna O and later on Freud's patients more or less say, shut up and listen to what I'm saying. However weird it is, however strange it is. So Freud has to learn a kind of clinical silence to listen to what's being said and what's not being said in what is being said, so to speak. Okay, a kind of listening to the language of hysteria, learn to decode it. And often it's a language of the body, what can't be put into speech but which is acted out through the body. Okay. So time structure is crucial here because the time structure gets more and more complicated. And the concept that Freud gradually evolves to try and grasp the temporal complexity of this, of the kind of the temporal causality of trauma is, again, this, I said often with Freud, there are problems of translation. Nachträglichkeit. Okay, I don't know if any, as you have German, you can split the word up into its component parts, okay? That's an abstract noun. Kite is like N-E-S-S at the end of English words, okay? Träger is the verb to carry or to bear. And nach is after, okay? The adjective nachträglich, or can be used as an adverb, is common enough, but Freud turns it into an abstract noun, okay? Strachey, the great translator of Freud in the standard edition, translates it as deferred action. Okay, and Le Planchon we'll be looking at later on in this term, the great translator of the French Strachey, so to speak, the translator of Freud's German into French, and the editor of the first Œuvre complète, the first proper Œuvre complète in French. His criticism of that is that its temporal direction is one way, deferred action from the present or the past into the future, the line of arrow of time going forward. Whereas what Freud's word is, or concept is struggling to catch, is the, yes, fine, there's a delay, there's a deferral, but there's also an action back again. Okay? And his suggestion, which is gradually catching on in English, of how to translate Freud's term properly, is afterwardsness. I mean, literally, Freud's word would be carrying afterness. Okay? And it's sometimes used, not the abstract noun, but the adjective to refer to people who have a grudge or a grievance. They carry something with them on afterwards. Okay? But there's also the question of the way in which the inscriptions of a past of traumatic event are reactivated by a second later event. And indeed, you know, the idea we can see developing, even glimpses of it in the 1893 paper, it's there in the very short case study of Katerina, and it's there in a much more complex way in the very interesting case study of Miss Lucy R. The idea is that it takes at least two events to create a trauma. In that sense, a psychical trauma, okay, is different from a physical trauma. The word trauma, of course, comes from the Greek meaning to pierce. A trauma was a wound, and it's still used like that in everyday medical discourse when doctors are talking about, you know, damaged bodies, a trauma to the left thigh, whatever, you know. It's a break, a breach, a wound in the boundary or the surface of the body. Gets metaphorically transposed to the mind, as it were, in which something has broken through the boundaries and defences of the conscious ego. some overwhelming excitation or force as it has broken through, as it were. But the difference between a physical trauma and a psychical trauma is summed up by LaPlanche in his commentary on the case of Emma in the part two psychopathology piece. Is it takes at least two events to create a trauma, okay, and a time lag and a retrospective action back from event two onto event one, as it were, the reactivation and reinterpretation of a first event that was unassimilable, in excess, overwhelming, unintegrated into the mind, okay, which is then reactivated at a later point. And the trauma only happens at the later point. There's a strange deferral in which something happens. It may be experienced at the time as negative or bad or whatever, but the hysteria only develops at a later point when some other event comes along. Okay. Now, that becomes more and more complex, that notion of deferral and retroaction, as it were, which is caught up in the idea of afterwardsness. The French phrase, so this is a nice one for those of you who know French, and that's après coup. An afterblow, as it were, which catches something of the ambiguity of a forward and a backward movement in time, as it were. And tracing that temporal structure through the case studies is very illuminating, and looking at the ways in which Freud tries to sort of grab this rather strange insight that he kind of bumps into, almost stumbles into, in the material of the case studies, as it were. Okay. I've got some time. What I want to do now is I've given you those nice photographs. I've also given you. Are there any spares at the back? Were there any? Is that a spare? Okay, that's fine. There are two little moments I've given you on this notion of afterwardsness, nachtraglichkeit, or deferred action, as he refers to it. This is on it's the third last page. it's an extract from Freud moves from a trauma theory to a sexual trauma theory, okay? From 1893 to 1895, he's talking about trauma, but he's not tying it specifically to sexuality. The question of sexuality is becoming central in the case of Emma, in 1895. 1896, he thinks he's got it. And he develops what's sometimes called the theory of seduction, the theory of sexual trauma, that the necessary first causal inscription to produce a hysteria must be some sort of aggressive sexual excitation in a pre-puberty child. And so he writes three papers in 1896 elaborating that theory, okay? And then in 1897, in September 1897, he writes a letter to Flea saying, God, I think I've got it all wrong for the following four reasons. And that's often taken to be a definitive moment. It's not. If you read the letters to Flea carefully, he oscillates back and forwards for the next three or four years. In fact, in some sense, Freud never quite makes up his mind. That is to say, the notion of trauma, when it's expunged at a certain point and then it keeps coming back again, as it were. Freud is haunted by the idea of trauma, even when he's officially, as it were, abandoned it, as it were. But on that, we're looking at one of the 1896 papers, the further remarks, because it has the only detailed and very interesting case study of the paranoid woman in that paper. In that particular context. This is an extract from another one of the 1896 papers where he's putting forward his sexual trauma theory. And what's interesting is the question here of memory and temporal structure. That's what I'm just zeroing in on. Okay. And that's page 213 at the right-hand side. I've put brackets around it, an arrow in the margin, to signal the sentences I'm interested in. He says he's considering a series of objections to his theory, that it's premature sexual experience in childhood that must be the first primal moment for hysteria. And he says, another objection might arise from exception being taken to the supposition that the memory of infantile sexual experience produces such an enormous pathogenic effect, while the actual experience itself has none. That's the puzzle of the argument. The first time round, it didn't give rise to a trauma. It only gave rise to a trauma when it was reactivated as a memory. That's the anomaly that he's claiming. It is true that we are not accustomed to the notion of powers emanating from a mnemic image, a memory image, which were absent from the real impression. You will moreover notice the consistency with which the proposition that symptoms can only proceed from memories is carried through in hysteria. None of the later scenes in which the symptoms arise are the effective ones, and the experiences which are effective at first have no result. Here we are faced with a problem which we may very justifiably keep separate from our main theme. So this is the anomaly and the curious temporality of trauma, okay? That, as it were, the traumatic symptomology only emerges often from a precipitating event that seems disproportionate. You know, why would that cause that, right? It just doesn't seem in intensity or in form to be related to the symptom. So the patient says, oh, the first time I got this, an example would be in the one he talks about in the Anna O case. She's been unable to drink water for months. She's almost dying of thirst. Why? Because she saw a dog drinking out of a bedside glass. You think, what? Why would that have that effect? Okay, it involves something that you might be disgusted by, a dog drinking out of somebody's glass of water. Why would you repress it and then hallucinate about it and then be unable to drink for months, right? But that's the moment she traces it back to. So in his first direct cause-effect paradigm, he thinks, oh, well, that's the cause. We've now got the cause. And it's all the more plausible in that when she has that memory, she's able to drink again. And so Breuer says, and Freud following him says, ah, we've found the cause because we've made the symptom vanish. Okay? Now, of course, he then comes very soon afterwards to feel, actually, this is not quite right. And in the psychopathology paper, which ends up giving us the case of Emma, there is a disproportion. He talks about these odd cases of disproportion and saying it's because they may be the precipitating factor, but behind them is something else. Okay. So that move becomes more and more elaborate. Okay. There is always something else. In other words, after a while, what happens in Freud's thought on trauma is that what he's describing is not a detachable set of events, even ones that can form a sequence. What he's kind of describing is a whole personal history. That is to say, there's a whole memorial structure there, and he's being pushed further and further and further and further back to understand why this anodyne event has this explosive traumatic result, as it were. What is being activated? It's not an inherited constitution, okay? It's a psychic history, okay? A particular structure of subjectivity, okay? Whose contradictions, explosive contradictions, are being detonated, if you like, at a later point. In the case of Emma, of course, the way he sees it there, and of course it seems to fit the facts of the case. You remember Emma is a young adult woman who comes into analysis with Freud, and she has this phobia about going into shops. She can't go into shops alone, and she hasn't been able to do this for years. She can go in if she's accompanied, even by a small child, but she can't go into shops alone. And in the course of the treatment with her, Freud says, when did this symptom first arise? And she says she can remember it quite well. Well, I was about 11 or 12 or 13. I went into this department store, and I saw these two young men who were assistants, and they were laughing together. And I felt they were laughing at me. I thought they were laughing at my clothes. And she rather fancies one of them. He's rather attractive. And then she gets this incredible fright, and she runs out of the shop, and she's no longer able to go into shops. Now, it's a good example of this odd disproportion, you know? Okay, so she seems to a young guy. She quite fancies him. They're laughing together, and she thinks, she makes two connections, or two false connections, Freud says. one is they're laughing at my clothes. And then he thinks it's a puzzle. The pieces don't fit together. How come she feels okay if she goes into a shop with a small child? The child's not going to protect her, right? She's frightened of something. What is it that she's frightened of? If she feels that her clothes, which were clothes when she was 12 or 13, her mother made her wear, she can now wear clothes of her own choice that she thinks are rather stylish or whatever. So, you know, what's this about clothes? Okay. The bits don't hang together of that scene to where her symptom first, a phobia first arises. And it's only by working with her around that an earlier set of scenes then comes up when she was 8, where she goes into a shop and she is abused by a shopkeeper who grins at her and puts his hand through her clothes to feel her genitals. And then she goes back a second time and feels terribly guilty. And there's a phrase from the German in inverted commas, she traced back her state of oppressive conscience. It's in inverted commas, so one assumes that that's Emma's own words about it. But what's curious is that it's the phobia that develops 4 years later, which then, as it were, stays with her and dominates her life into adulthood. And Freud says only by mapping the second scene onto the first scene that one can see how the undischarged traumatic drama of the first scene gets discharged through the apparently innocent, non-sexual second scene, as it were. And Freud's then explanation for it is, between these two moments, puberty has happened. Okay, and she can now realise, oh my God, that's what he was doing. That's what that experience, I didn't like it at the time, or I was puzzled by it, or whatever. That's what it was all about. So for Freud, at this, and again, it's a very specific moment in Freud's thought, it's to do with the puberty as a threshold. The assumption there, of course, is that before puberty, the human being is asexual and only becomes sexual with the development of the genital organs at puberty. Now, this is something Freud himself is already, in a different part of his mind, in a different set of letters to Fleece, is challenging and beginning to think, well, actually, there are all kinds of strange sort of sexual and erotic elements of infantile behaviour, etc., that we don't really understand. But he doesn't put the two things together. He's thinking, oh, well, that puberty explains what this odd structure of Nachträglichkeit, this odd temporal structure. And then he realises at a certain point there's a whole set of thresholds, puberty is only one of them, in which a kind of translation needs to take place from the experiences of one moment of development into the terms and language of understanding of a later moment, as it were. And that translation very often doesn't take place. It's when that translation fails and something is left behind that we get what he calls repression, as it were. And he is also moving gradually from a model of repression is something that's pathological. It's a pathological defense. And that's how he talks about it in sections 1, 2, and 3 of the same paper, which ends up with the case of Emma. Okay, repression is something hysterics do or obsessional neurotics do. It's a pathological strategy for self-defense, and it splits off the mind. It splits, and therefore you get a condition seconde, a second grouping, mental grouping that is inaccessible to consciousness, but seeks continually to return or to infiltrate its way. But it's pathological, and our aim is to dissolve the unconscious and to stop people repressing. Okay, it's temporary, it's pathological, and the aim is to abolish the unconscious. Okay. And then, but what he keeps bumping into is the fact that the unconscious can't be abolished, that repression can't simply be reversed, and that what he's kind of bumping into is that it's a permanent structural feature of human psychic organization. In other words, that there is a necessary primal repression which organizes the structure of the mind. And there may be later secondary repressions, some of which are quite pathological or damaging. But that there is, as it were, a normal unconscious. I hate to use the word normal because it's got carries so many misleading connotations. But there is a kind of normal, inevitable structure of splitting, repression, and a formation of an unconscious system, which is a permanent structure of the mind. And takes Freud a while, as it were, to arrive at that position. He's still working very much with the notion, right up to the book on dreams, really, that that the unconscious is something that has to be liquidated, okay, by bringing it out, by getting it verbalized. He gives up hypnosis pretty quickly. For him, language, the putting of things into language, takes the place of hypnosis, as it were. The strategy of getting the patient to reenact in their mind and to put into words what has been unavailable to them through chains of association that becomes the key factor. And of course, for that to happen, the doctor has to stop asking questions, or rather, he has to stop allowing his questions to set the agenda. By all means, ask questions, but the patient has to set the agenda. The analytic session has to begin with the patient saying whatever comes into their mind, as it were, suppressing their own self-censorship mechanisms as much as possible, and just allowing whatever it is to come out, as it were, which is a very difficult process. Then maybe questions might be asked, as it were. So a symptom-oriented technique gradually gives way to a technique which centres on the patient as a speaker. What Anna O, Breuer's first patient, called the talking cure. Okay, the role of speech then becomes crucial. Okay, I think probably I should finish at that point. Now, who here is in which the 9 o'clock class? Who's here in the 9 o'clock from the 9 o'clock class? First of all, apologies for the time. I really, as I said in my email, wanted it to be at least 9:30, if not 10. It's just we've all been pushed back by the students' union asking not to have lectures at lunchtime on Wednesdays. So, can you put your hands up again? Okay, that's quite a few of you, isn't it? 2, 4, 6, 8. What I'd like is maybe in pairs, if you could do, I'm being really arbitrary here, just to take a few notes about the case of, say, of Katharina, the short one, okay? If you two could take a few notes about the case of Miss Lucy R, okay? You're not the 9 o'clock one. You're at 9 o'clock? Somebody else from the 9 o'clock class? Maybe you two could do something about the case of, who have we got? Emma, okay? And were you two from the 9 o'clock class? Could you think about the paranoid woman case? Okay, which is in the further remarks essay. Okay, and I'm not asking you to write a paper about it. You jot down notes, problems, things you don't understand about it, questions you want to ask about it. Okay, just to get the discussion going. Okay, I'm going to do the same with the rest of you from the 10:30 class. Okay, could you put your hands up so I can see who you are? Okay, and I'm just going to really be very arbitrary here. I'll do the same thing. Could you two introduce what's the first of the cases? Say the simplest one, Katharina. Okay, what was the next two? Could you do, you two there, could you do... Sorry? Yeah. Yeah, okay, good. Okay, could you do the Lucy R case? I'll work these out in advance later, but I haven't seen you. Could you do, you're sitting there, could you do, what goes after that? The Emma case, okay. I think you might be by yourself. Could you just say something about the paranoid woman in the further remarks essay? Great. Okay, see you all tomorrow. And I think I already warned the 9 o'clock people, on the basis of the experience students had last year, getting in for nine can be a problem. You really have to start early. I've had endless tales of people standing in the parade in Leamington as one bus after another goes by. So you really have to leave the house at 7:30, I'm told. Okay, see you all tomorrow.